This is community radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF, and now another presentation of Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Elbert Big Man Howard.
Attention, KWTF listeners. This is a revolutionary new program now streaming live on KWTF. On the web at www.ktwf.net. It is entitled Voices from Behind the Walls. The focus of this program is to introduce you, the listener, to and give voice to the works of talented authors and others who are incarcerated in prisons across the nation. Many talented individuals are locked behind walls in prison, living in other countries, and because of this are virtually and effectively silenced. Some of the most eloquent writers have actually been locked away for over 40 years. A good percentage of them are political prisoners, caught up in the government's COINTELPRO assault against the Black Panther Party and other progressive organizations. KWTF Radio is now giving them a voice in our community. Please tune in to KWTF on the web at www.kwtf.net and join your host, Elbert Big Man Howard, every Saturday and Sunday for Voices from Behind the Walls.
My name is David Engel. We are continuing to read from Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther by Marshall Eddie Conway and Dominique Stevenson. This is Chapter 5, Door of No Return. In addition to the murder of Fred Hampton, the beginning of December 1969 had brought with it the chilly news of an all-day siege upon the Los Angeles office. The firefight involved armored cars and helicopters and launched the newly formed SWAT, or Special Weapons and Tactics Team, an ultra-militarized police unit in Los Angeles that would soon filter out into police precincts across the country. This was, of course, a pre-dawn attack, which seemed to be the modus operandi for these kind of offensives. It resulted in a number of injuries and 18 arrests, among them two more Central Committee members. By this point, the Baltimore chapter had begun to implement a number of strategies to counteract the attacks we were experiencing. Members had been working to establish chapters in Washington, D.C., Reading, Pennsylvania, and Wilmington, Delaware. Members from the Baltimore chapter were dispatched to each of these regions, and they would bring back new recruits to our offices to be trained. The chapters in D.C. and Delaware would ultimately grow and develop into active organizations that survived longer than any of Maryland's chapters. Back home, there was an office in East Baltimore, one in South Baltimore, and another one in Annapolis, with plans to establish a new one in West Baltimore. This was the last area of Baltimore to be organized. The Panthers had been in the area for some time already, selling newspapers and holding small rallies, when we decided to move our main office to Pennsylvania Avenue, which was, and still is, one of the main arteries on the west side. A few of us also moved to the area and began to seek out a good location for our new office. Our newspaper sales were increasing in the community, and residents wanted to know when we would start some programs there. There had been an increase in police violence in the area. We witnessed two major block-wide police raids within a three-month period, in which everyone on the street was held and searched by the infamous tactical squads that the police department had put in place to conduct raids in what they deemed nuisance areas. To me, it called up images of Nazi Germany, because it was becoming increasingly clear that neither the Constitution, nor the Bill of Rights, nor any of those documents that claim liberty and justice for all were worth the paper that they were written on. Human rights were violated all the time in poor communities like Sandtown and Uptown, where our main office was about to be relocated. In no time at all, incidents between the police and neighborhood youth led to a mini riot, and in the aftermath, there was a shootout that led to the deaths of a brother who lived in the neighborhood and a policeman. Police claimed the shootings were the result of a drug raid. The Panthers had been negotiating for the lease on a building a block away from the site of the incident. The following week, there was a shooting a few blocks in the other direction. One police officer was killed and another wounded. The blame for this incident was laid at the feet of the Panthers. From what we could gather from the police reports, a patrol car had been dispatched to investigate a disturbance at a house in the area sometime during the night. The officers left but were later called back, and the shooting occurred soon after their return. Not long after that, we heard that two of our members had been arrested near the site of the shootings, and they were being held. I was subsequently arrested at my job and held for the earlier FBI indictments involving the missing informant. My arrest occurred 2 days after the shootings, and in the course of the next few days, some 24 members of our chapter would be arrested on various charges, ranging from possession of arms to murder to interstate flight. This was the long-expected final assault on the entire leadership of our chapter. The defense captain was kidnapped by agents from California. Our main office was set on fire, and many of our members' apartments were raided, resulting in the loss of most of the chapter's political materials and records, many of which were removed from the office by the Baltimore City Fire Department and turned over to the police. Upon arrest, all of our members were placed in a special section of the Baltimore City Jail, the Lockup and Punishment Unit. A few of our members were held in secret at other jails in an attempt to make them appear to be informants or to disguise the fact that they were. I was held as an accessory before and after the fact in the murder of an FBI informant. After being held for 2 months with no real evidence against me, the judge in the case ordered the state's attorney to release me or give a better reason for holding me. During this time, the state was holding Jack Johnson and attempting to get him to testify against me. Not so coincidentally, an informant was transferred into my cell. Charles Reynolds was recognized by other prisoners who had served time with him in the Maryland House of Corrections. Some of these men were in the receiving area when he was processed into the jail and sent word to me that an informant was being assigned to my cell. I would later find out that through an arrangement with the Baltimore City Police Department, he was being transported from the Jessup, Maryland prison complex to serve out the balance of his time in Michigan, where he was from. This was an unusual move for a prisoner coming from a maximum security prison and being sent to another state to serve out time because the Baltimore City Jail was a minimum security facility where prisoners served short sentences or were held pending trial and sentencing. Prisoners from a state prison were generally transferred directly from one state's facility to the next state. I was aware that they were trying to build a case against me on the police shootings, but I wasn't all that concerned at the time because I was innocent. When word came up that a police informant was being specifically assigned to the cell I was in, though, I knew I had a problem. I thought maybe the government wanted me to attack him or have someone attack him so that they could continue holding me as a threat to the community. I also knew that this informant was being placed there to build a case against me in the police shootings, so I protested his placement in my cell. The guards refused to place him in another cell, saying that they had their orders. I would later learn that the Baltimore City Police Commissioner, a man named Palmer Lau, had been called to Washington, D.C. to meet with Attorney General John Mitchell, who, according to the newspaper reports, was under orders to make the charges against us stick, whatever the cost. With that in mind, a number of things happened around the same time. First, the police informant was eventually removed from my cell and shipped to Michigan to serve out a sentence there, but he would later give a statement implicating me in exchange for favorable recommendations from the state's attorney's office concerning his sentence in Michigan. Next, Jackie Johnson, one of the two Panthers arrested almost immediately following the shootings, gave a statement against me under the agreement that he receive immunity from prosecution. Once on the stand, he would refuse to testify, so the statement was not to be used in the trial. I would find out later that Jack's statement was the result of beatings and intimidation by the police. And finally, a police officer who was involved in the aftermath of the shooting claimed he could identify me because I had been living in the neighborhoods surrounding Pennsylvania Avenue all of my life. This came as a complete surprise to me, as I had only moved there in the last 6 months, around the time we decided to put an office on the west side. When finally I went to court on these charges, the trial lasted 7 days. I recall very little about it, since I spent the entire time in the bullpen, the lockup section of the court. I had been fighting a losing battle with the judge and DA about having a lawyer from the Black Panther Party represent me in the case. I had problems with the lawyer situation since my arrest. Milton B. Allen, who was one of the best black lawyers in the city at the time, came to see me on the pretense that he was considering representing my case. We talked for about an hour and he left, after assuring me that he would get back to me. He never returned to see me again, and it wasn't a week later that I learned that he had been offered the opportunity to run for state's attorney. In fact, he was the state's attorney during the time I was tried. I always wondered how much of what I discussed with him went to his assistance. By that point, I had realized that I couldn't trust any lawyers in the city because they were subject to pressure and bribes as part of the establishment with their future interests at stake. So I decided that I had to get a political lawyer, since this was a political case receiving real dirty political treatment. I would try to get a lawyer from the regional area office, which was located in New York. The Black Panther Party was financially in trouble because of the massive amounts of money being drained from it in the form of bail and legal fees for other members around the country. Since I had been locked up, some 20 or more attacks had taken place in different cities, each one resulting in arrests and bails or future trials. Part of the government's attack upon the party had been to lock up as many members as possible to keep the party's funds depleted. This ploy was in full swing by the time of my arrest, and the membership was chipping in to help bail arrested comrades out of jail. The real source of money for the chapters was the sale of our newspapers, and that was under attack also. The Maryland State chapter is having real problems with the newspaper at the local airport end of things. Each week, they would lose or misplace thousands of our newspapers. The newspapers a chapter received made it possible to pay the rent for the office space and feed the children and party members sometimes. Many members didn't have paying jobs and lived off of the funds they earned selling the newspapers. The continued loss of the paper sales cost the chapter great sums of money. Only later was it revealed that this was another attack orchestrated by the FBI. A later released memo from FBI headquarters made it clear that the government believed that the Black Panther Party newspaper was one of the most effective propaganda operations of the party, and they were right, but the memo didn't stop there. Distribution of this newspaper is increasing at a regular rate, it went on, thereby influencing a greater number of individuals in the United States along the black extremist lines. Each recipient submitted proposed counterintelligence measures, which will hinder the vicious propaganda being spread by the BPP. The newspaper is the voice of the BPP, and if it could be effectively hindered, it would result in helping to cripple the Black Panther Party. Well, so much for freedom of the press and the First Amendment rights of U.S. citizens. In any case, that sure didn't seem to apply to blacks. In January 1970, the main distribution center for the Black Panther newspaper in San Francisco was hit by an arson fire that destroyed tens of thousands of papers. Because of these continued attacks from the government agencies, our members' legal defense fund was greatly limited. Along with the mounting legal costs, there was also a real shortage of political lawyers. An extraordinary number of movement people were under attack in America at the same time, and the lawyers were needed by the anti-war groups, the American Indian Movement, the radical student movements, the Puerto Rican independence movement, the Mexican-American movement, the left church movement, and the prison movement. There simply were not enough lawyers to go around, and besides that, the political lawyers themselves were under attack, meaning that less and less of them were willing or able to carry on in the courts. Safe to say there was a waiting list a mile long to get a political lawyer. I was waiting for one of them myself. While I was waiting, though, I had to get some things done on my situation. We hired a city lawyer to deal with these things, with the understanding that as soon as we got a political lawyer, he or she would handle the case. I was to be assigned a lawyer from William Kunstler's office in New York. After this was explained to the judge, he assigned a public defender to the case with the understanding that I was waiting on the lawyer out of New York, who would be handling the case. The judge asked for proof of this, so William Kunstler appeared in court to explain all of this in person. He requested 30 days to get his law partner down to Baltimore. The lawyer was in the middle of another case and needed time to finish it. The judge agreed, and then, despite this agreement, scheduled the trial for 3 days later, with the public defender I'd only met with 3 times, and only for 15 minutes on those occasions. Later, a prominent Baltimore attorney would state to my supporters that Mr. McAllister was placed on the case because he had some level of credibility. But, he said, by that point in his career, McAllister was no longer competent. He had become an alcoholic, and he was sometimes drunk during the trial. I was not willing to go to a rigged trial with a drunken public defender, and I stated that position clearly in court. The judge and DA decided to move ahead with the case before a lawyer from Kunstler's firm could come down and get involved. I continued to protest, but they went right on with the proceedings. I made it clear that I was not going to allow this court-assigned lawyer to represent me in this case. My life was on the line. I fired him, and the judge continued with the case anyway. He said he had to make sure I got a fast and speedy trial because it was my right. Yet there were brothers over at the city jail waiting to go to trial for almost 2 years in some cases. I could see they intended to have a show, with or without a lawyer I could trust. At that point, I decided if they were planning a legal lynching, I would not step easily into the noose. So I called it what it was, a sham. The least act of resistance, I mean the absolute minimal thing that I could do to resist this, was for me to leave the courtroom in protest. So I made this point clear and then left. I only returned to participate in the trial when forced to, or when my cell partner, Arthur Turco, urged me to. He was one of the BPP's lawyers at the time, and he had been arrested in New York and charged in the informant case in Baltimore and was being held at the jail. During this time, Turco was the chairman of the Patriot Party, a radical white, new left political party. We had been in the cell together since they had brought him down from New York. He had been advising me on the legal aspects of my case, and I asked the judge on numerous occasions to allow me to use him as my attorney since I could trust him. The judge initially agreed, but later changed his mind. I never doubted for a minute that the judge was under a lot of pressure from someone above him. So much for justice in America. I had no pretense about the fact that American justice was meted out in larger portions for the rich, while the poor could only cross their fingers and hope. Each day, the courtroom was packed with people from the community, and this led to a number of threats from the judge about limiting the number of people that would be allowed to watch the trial. I watched each day's proceedings on a local news station at night to find out what had happened that day. Since I wasn't at the trial, I am forced to rely on the transcript of the court proceedings. Many thoughts raced through my mind during the days that the trial went on, but most often I wondered how many other people, poor and black, had come through this system looking for justice and receiving nothing, not even some good lies. The justice system, like other institutions in the U.S., was working night and day to suppress anyone who posed a threat to the rich and powerful of this country. Its sole purpose, as far as I could see, was to maintain a system that operated in the interest of a small group of criminals like Richard Nixon, who were bombing and killing people at that very moment in Cambodia, Vietnam, and even on U.S. college campuses, like Jackson State in Mississippi, Kent State in Ohio, and Southern University down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. All had suffered deaths and injuries during the late 60s and 70s. Thousands of people in the U.S. and around the world were dying because of the international and economic policies directed by a tiny minority, less than 1% of the population, who owned and controlled 85% of the country's wealth. These killers used war and genocide as a means of securing a global economy for themselves. I knew that if these folks would kill their own children like they did at Kent State, they would surely use the heavy hand of government to swat us panthers like so many roaches. I had no illusions about receiving justice in America. The legal violations that had been perpetrated against me to get a conviction seemed to be so far beyond the bounds of the legal system that I just couldn't understand how normal people could possibly be fooled by the state's actions. But then again, these very same people had re-elected Nixon, and he was a crook. They had elected Agnew, and he was a crook. They believed Johnson about the Vietnam War and accepted verbatim the Warren Commission report about the Kennedy assassination. They even believed Hoover while he was tapping their phones. A Apparently they would believe anything, so why not this? The 7 days of my trial demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that this country is indeed a police state. The only people who had a voice during my trial were police, government informers, and government employees. I did not participate, and they did not honor my right to choose an attorney. The whole rap back then, like now, was about law and order. I felt the whole process was unlawful and quite out of order. Those of us from the BPP, the AIM, and other such movements who were being locked up were, for the most part, raising issues that needed to be addressed in the U.S. It was, however, the demand for self-determination that posed the greatest threat to the government's agenda. This could put a stop to the oppression and genocide in the Black and Native communities, and even draw the war in Vietnam to an end as people refused to go. It could potentially change conditions for poor and working-class people around the country. Activists were targeted and locked up, while the people who had stolen vast quantities of the world's resources from the rest of us would continue to do so. The wealthy and powerful summarily broke the same laws that they swore by, violating their own constitution as well as every civil and human right known to humankind. These wealthy and powerful people would decide who was guilty and who would be jailed, and in the case of some, who lived and who died. When we charged genocide, the same people were quick to point out that this was not Nazi Germany. After all, they said, in America we have a justice system in which one is presumed innocent until proven guilty, and an individual has a right to a jury of his or her own peers. There are no gas ovens here, it is true, but genocide is the deliberate destruction of an ethnic group, and the targeting of Blacks and Native peoples in the United States in those years was certainly that. The United States of America is the only major nation in the United Nations that refuses to recognize genocide as a crime, though it was designated as such under international law by the UN General Assembly when it approved the Convention on the Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in December 1949. It is no wonder when one considers the mass arrests of African-descended and Native youth, the flooding of these communities with alcohol and drugs, rendering them lifeless, and finally the use of sterilization as a birth control practice for women of color. Justice? There is none. I was found guilty after the violation of my constitutional rights, my civil rights, and my human rights. It was predetermined that I would go to prison while the real crooks went back to their estates to map out the future of the empire. Shortly before I was moved to the Baltimore City jail in February of 1971, there was a major riot, the result of long-ignored concerns over food and visiting conditions in the jail. I had been awaiting the outcome of my appeal and had not yet been moved to a prison. Because of my influence among some of the younger brothers in the jail who viewed me as a leader, I got the blame for the incident along with Arthur Turco. The reality is that when a riot occurs, there are usually no actual leaders, only people relieving their frustrations and other people staying out of their way. The afternoon that the riot took place, I had been summoned by a guard who said that I had a visit. After spending a mere 10 minutes with my visitor, I was told by the guard that my time was up because visiting hours were over. Naturally, I protested, stating my anger with the guard who, it turned out, had deliberately kept my visitor waiting nearly 2 hours before he decided to bring me up for the visit. My protestations led to an argument with the guard, and we began to scuffle. Soon enough, other prisoners, including the actor Charles Dutton, who was awaiting trial, joined me in the beef, and before we knew it, at least a dozen guards were involved. At some point during the altercation, a prisoner grabbed a set of keys and opened the cells on the L wing. The men in that section armed themselves with whatever they could find, mop handles and metal bars, and suddenly it was on. The guards tossed tear gas canisters into the area, but it did not stop the men as they tossed mattresses from the cells and threw trash cans from the upper tier. During the fight with the guards, I had been dragged off to the hole. The other prisoners began negotiating with officials, but refused to compromise until they were made aware of what was happening to me. For my part, I was stripped naked and thrown into a cold, dank, dark space with a mattress on the floor and a hole in the middle for waste. I had to survive on a diet of water and 3 sandwiches a day. Sometimes they had bologna and sometimes cheese, but never both. I guess I was supposed to be happy for either one, but as time progressed and the stench coming from that hole in the floor engulfed the space, I lost my appetite. They kept me locked in 24 hours a day for 3 weeks until I was transported to the courthouse and sentenced to life plus 30 years. This experience did not break my resolve to resist the repression. It merely awakened me to the world I had entered and would walk in for years to come. It was such a profound experience that I will probably carry it with me into my next life. When the door slammed shut on me in the hole, I shuddered because it evoked a strange feeling of deja vu. But it would be some time before I fully understood this eerily familiar feeling. It was the echo of other doors that offered no return for those who crossed through. In my mind, I could see the faces of those Africans, perhaps even my own ancestors, who were forced to cross the threshold of the door of no return. I sensed that the people left something of themselves there, caged for eternity. These castles on the coasts of West Africa are all that remain of the people who were snatched away. Those who survived the forced passage would become a different people of a different mind, with thoughts shaped by the bondage in which they lived. The shadows of who they had been would remain in the ruins of those old castles, and the shadows of who they would become are caged here in this country in newly ruined castles called prisons. I was eventually charged and convicted of assault on the guard. I left the Baltimore City Jail and went directly to the Maryland Penitentiary, an awful structure that is reminiscent of a medieval castle. It is a fortress of sorts, but not one designed to protect its inhabitants. Rather, the design of the building has a direct relationship to oppression, from the structure's connection to slavery and the slave trade, right on to the present function of warehousing the disappeared from the state's poor black communities. The penitentiary housed those people who had often posed a threat to society. Runaway black women and men who refused the hands dealt to them under slavery. Anti-slavery abolitionists and Quakers who interfered with the institution, and those poor whites that did not fit into an economic picture based on slave labor. The first prisoner to cross the threshold of the Maryland Penitentiary in 1811 was a man of African descent named Negro Bob. A rendering of his face and that of his warden graced the stone entryway of the prison. I suspect that the last man out of the door will be of African descent as well.
This is Marty McReynolds, and we're continuing with the book Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther by Marshal Eddie Conway and Dominique Stevenson. And this is Chapter 6, Slave Ship. It took most of the day to get processed into the prison. I was confronted with multiple tiers of cells that were filled with nothing but black bodies in cages. Coming out of the isolation of the hole at the city jail felt like I had emerged from a dark alley onto a four-lane highway. The penitentiary was a swirl of activity, guards changing shifts, prisoners being checked in and processed out, visitors arriving and leaving the place, and civilian employees going back and forth performing their tasks. The time in the hole had forced me into quiet reflection and contemplation. I resolved to never give up my struggle for freedom for me or for my people, so the penitentiary represented to me just another level of struggle. Though I was now consigned to a life of imprisonment, I had but one immediate thing on my mind, the fact that I had not eaten a full meal in the past 21 days had me looking forward to some food. It was about 5 p.m. before it was time for our section to go to the mess hall. The place was a long, square building sitting in the middle of the yard, away from all the other buildings in the compound. It was at least 100 years old and looked it, both inside and out. Off to the left side, near the front and extending toward the center of this huge room, were the serving counters. Lined up behind these counters was a row of prisoners dressed in whites. We filed through this area, picking up metal trays and utensils as we passed the deposit points. From that point onward, food was piled upon your tray, depending on whether you kept it on the counter or withdrew it in front of this or that item. Needless to say, I kept my tray upon the counter the full route, and the result was a full tray of meat, vegetables, potatoes, bread, and chocolate pudding. I was ready to eat for days. By this point, I may well have lost 20 pounds as a result of the previous 3 weeks of sandwiches three times a day, which made up my entire diet. Most of the sandwiches contained meats that I did not eat anyway. Finally, our section went to sit down at the rows of tables that covered the entire back half of the mess hall. Each row of tables was filled up before the next row was used. The guards would stand at the edge of the tables and direct the prisoner to sit in this seat or that seat, depending on which ones are empty. Up until now, all of my experiences with meals while incarcerated were in the city jail. As soon as I had arrived at the jail, I was sent to the lockup section, where prisoners are kept in cells at all times, including during meals. There, I could consume my food at my own pace, and once I was finished, I would put my disposable trays outside. The section cleanup man would collect the containers and clean up the area. Sometimes I would consume my food over the span of several hours, depending on what I was doing when the trays got passed out. For example, if I were playing a game of chess with the man in the next cell, the game might last for another hour before someone wins. The food may go untouched the whole time the game is going on. Now, after living and eating like this for over 11 months, the penitentiary arrangement was a new experience for me. So, as I sat down to eat, and not at a slow pace, as I was truly hungry, I was completely surprised to hear the guard tell everyone, "Okay, that's enough, let's go." I watched everyone from my table get up and file out to the trash can area and out the door. I never moved because I still had half a tray of food and bad teeth to boot. I was really trying to speed things up when a guard stopped in front of me and asked what I thought I was doing. Well, between mouthfuls, I told him that I was trying to eat my supper and that I was only halfway through and had bad teeth. By the time I was 21 years old and in the Army, I had lost half of the teeth in the back of my mouth, and the remaining ones were not in the best of shape. I had learned to always take my time when eating. I quickly learned that I was never again going to have that luxury. Now I was supposed to do what the guards told me to do. Thinking about the situation now, I suppose I must have been some sight, even in a prison, sitting there eating like a starving man, funky because I had not had a shower in 3 weeks. My hair was long and uncombed from being in the hole all that time. And because of the weight loss, I had an emaciated appearance. My transfer to the penitentiary had afforded me my first look in the mirror in 3 weeks, and it was a shock. The guard said that my meal was over and that I had to go. I really didn't understand any of this at the time. It just didn't make any sense. Why give people food to eat and then make them throw half of it away? Well, that will never make sense to a hungry man. And at that time, that's just what I was. The whole time that this was happening, I had not missed a beat in my eating, nor was I making any effort to be rebellious. I just simply wanted to finish my meal and return to my cell, as I was exhausted from the day's activities. The next thing I knew, there were 10 to 15 guards at my table, telling me that I'd better hurry up or else. Well, my mouth was full, and I had another spoonful of food waiting for an opening. So I felt like I was doing my best. I knew that something was going wrong here, and after upwards of 30 prisoners started to mill around the guards and started making statements like, "Leave him alone and let the man eat," I knew that there was a situation developing here, and it was starting to involve more people than myself. I decided to finish my meal, or rather declare that I had had enough and move out. I did that for a number of reasons. First, I had no way of knowing just what was going on with the meal situation. It was my first day in the penitentiary, and I wasn't trying to create any conflicts. And second, I didn't know who these prisoners were who came to my aid, and I didn't want to involve them in any bullshit beefs. I left, to the great relief of everyone. As I was leaving, I decided to find out just what the situation surrounding the mess hall and the meals was. I had a number of questions. As I emptied my tray into the trash cans full of food that prisoners were forced to throw away, the main question was, why was it so important to get everyone out of the mess hall in the shortest possible time? Why was the potential for violence so great over such a minor issue? The answer I would discover over the next few days was an odd rationale, but then again, incarceration is often in conflict with what is rational. What I was able to surmise is that the prison, and prisoners in general, was run on a loose basis because the control and enforcement machinery are concentrated in a few key areas. The two areas used most often to reinforce control over prisoners are the mess halls and the visiting rooms. Both are of great importance to prisoners and guards alike. The prisoners receive sustenance and human interaction in the mess hall and visiting room, and the guards are able to demonstrate their force because the prisoners are the most vulnerable in those spaces. The mess hall is used just like Pavlov used food to train his dogs. The one area prisoners must appear in at least once a day is the mess hall. In this area, they are made to file through and sit in seats appointed by any guards working mess hall duty. It is important for the authority of the guard force to be reinforced in the minds of prisoners on a daily basis, and the most effective training of animals and humans seems to occur through the use and control of food and its consumption. Friends are made and lost by what happens around the food trays. All of the new guards, the rookies, are trained in the mess hall. It's their first lesson in how to command and control prisoners. For their part, prisoners are hungry and simply want to get some food in their bellies. The regularity with which a prisoner is told where to sit and how long to stay creates a learned response that requires no thought. The prisoner becomes institutionalized, and when that same prisoner is given a directive by a guard, whether it is to walk, run, or eat, the response is automatic, because the conditioning already occurred in the mess hall through the daily reinforcement of control and command. The visiting room offers the same type of conditioning stimuli, but the mess hall affords the guards the best opportunity to demonstrate force and thereby send a message to the population as a whole. Thus, the least amount of resistance to any guard's authority is met with immediate force without compromise. The mess hall is a public forum, and the lessons taught there are intended for the collective body of prisoners present at any given time. Since most prisoners are not trying to get involved in mass riot types of situations, many will just watch an altercation develop. See the guard force come together and concentrate upon one or two prisoners who may be supporting a friend who is about to be taken away. The ensuing situation almost always results in the prisoners receiving a ticket, the prison's way of charging prisoners for offenses real or imagined, for inciting a riot, which carries a heavy penalty second only to assault on a guard. The lesson learned by most during these incidents is generally that a prisoner has no way to win in that kind of situation. Prisoners, for the most part, return to their housing area and maybe discuss what happened to so-and-so and how bad or mean Officer so-and-so was, and how he was always doing something like this and causing trouble. The next time the general population sees the prisoners who had the conflict in the mess hall, it is months later. He looks bad after 3 months on lockup with few showers, half rations of food, and daily combat situations, as well as little exercise and fewer visits. The likelihood is great that he will get into a conflict and return to lockup in a week or less. Otherwise, he has changed his behavior or tact in dealing with the guard force. This tends to reinforce the lesson for the general population. Prisoners tend to experience most of their conflicts around the food issue, and the most rebellious actions tend to come out of conflicts between prisoners and around the quality of the food or the harassment received while getting or trying to eat it. The fact that a group of prisoners comes together and supports one another is a crime in and of itself. It is highly unusual for this to occur in the mess hall, but when it does, it is treated as an unforgivable offense, which is what I quickly found out on that very first night in the penitentiary. Once I returned to my cell, I sat down to write to a few friends, letting them know that I had been moved to the prison. As I sat on my bunk writing, a guard came to my door and stopped to look in for a minute or so. Naturally, this attracted my attention. But before any interaction could take place, he was gone. I thought about this a few seconds before continuing my letter, only to discover a commotion outside of my cell door. This time, the officer was accompanied by a captain and a lieutenant. The lieutenant says to the captain, "Here he is," and the captain peeks into the cell and asks, "Where is this big, bad, 250-pound tough guy?" "Not him," and then continues, "Why are you giving my officers trouble?" I attempted to explain that I didn't understand that someone could be rushed through supper and run out of the mess hall with half of the food uneaten. I wanted to know what the point was of giving people food that they were not allowed to consume, and why such a big deal was made over a guy attempting to finish his meal. It's not like I was trying to burn down the place or something. Anyway, he wasn't there to listen to me, or even for that matter to talk to me. He had merely been sent to warn me. Don't get involved with prisoners in the mess hall, and don't start no trouble in their prison. And he was gone. Over an hour later, a prisoner showed up and asked me if I was okay and brought me some magazines. He told me that the brothers said that if I needed anything, to just let someone know that I wanted to see a Black Panther. Well, this was surely news to me. During the time that I had spent in the BPP in Baltimore, I was involved in all the organizing of the new chapters at one point or another. I had no knowledge of any organizing going on in the Maryland Penitentiary. I thought, perhaps, that these were some fallen comrades that I was unaware of. Anyway, I looked forward to meeting the brothers the next day. My first day out of the cell was a few days after the mess hall incident. I was sent to the hospital for a physical checkup. I was in the waiting room when the brother in charge of the Panthers came in and identified himself as the field marshal. With him were two of his lieutenants and a rank-and-file member. This brother had been dealing with the South Baltimore branch of the Panthers. He impressed me as well-read and informed on the party and its programs. One look at this brother, with his big red bush and dark glasses, his field jacket and boots, took me back to the days in Oakland and the party convention. I talked to these brothers for the hours I spent down at the hospital waiting for the physical. I was sorry to find out, after really talking to them, that they were more show and reaction than knowledge and action. I think I decided at that point not to get involved with them. I believed that they were stand-up brothers, but they demonstrated little to no discipline and lacked organizational skills and structure. However, they had already decided that I was the new, though unofficial, leader, and therefore I would take charge. Well, of course, this wasn't in my program at all. First, I was determined not to work to reform a criminal system that was oppressing my people. And second, my feelings were that I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time fucking around with a bunch of prison conditions and minor problems that ignored the real issues or solutions to the larger issue of oppression. I was concerned with the issues that were affecting our survival, the conditions that our communities were being subjected to, the repression and oppression that the political and economic arrangement in America was creating to our continued disadvantage, the massive killings of our youth and the developing drug problem in our neighborhoods, the hungry children in our streets, and the massive unemployment among our men. These were the kinds of things that concerned me at that time on the national level. The international situation in relation to Vietnam, Africa, and South America held what remained of my attention. I really had no time for the food conditions of the penitentiary or the facts that the guards were real pigs. It was what I expected to be a part of the program in prison. After all, our brother George Jackson was going through hell out in California. This didn't mean that I was completely insensitive to the plight of the prisoners there. Rather, I didn't think that organizing under these conditions would really have any kind of an impact on the prisoners or their conditions. At the time, I just couldn't see how organizing inside of a prison would benefit black people in general. I had no understanding of how the growth of the prison industrial complex would affect African-descended and Latino communities. Nor was I cognizant of the fact that the growth coincided with the struggle for self-determination and black power that many of us in the Black Panther Party had been committed to. It was only after spending some time with a number of these brothers that I realized that a good many of them were really very serious and were trying to gain an understanding of the forces and factors that were having such dire impact on black people in particular, but also oppressed people in general. I was suddenly faced with the fact that I needed to re-examine my position. After some soul-searching, I asked myself if I should, or really could, allow these brothers to continue to struggle and seek knowledge on their own. The answer was easy. I knew that I could aid in their growth and development if I spent some time with them. After all, the key duty of any real activist is to educate as many people as possible to the conditions or positions of the movement and the struggle. Here was a group of really raw brothers crying out to be molded and mentored for the benefit of the masses. I was committed to change, and if I could help a number of these brothers raise their consciousness and take a position like mine for the good of community, then I would do it. And so, within the first few weeks of my confinement, I was already engaged in organizing a number of activities. Since I had been doing this kind of work on the streets, it had become second nature, and so it wasn't hard to get the ball rolling inside. Prison has always been a fertile ground for organizing. There is always a highly motivated segment, however small, among the population, because prisoners live under the most oppressive conditions that one can imagine. Outside, in the community at large, it could be more difficult to motivate people. Community organizers are always faced with a number of distractions. The amount of time needed to deal with employment and travel between home and the office. The time needed to maintain a reasonable social life or partnership of some type. Other distractions, like family-related situations or the showdown at the Civic Center. Prisoners have none of these distractions. In prison, the job is right there in the compound, and the travel time is nil. The family and social situation is limited at best to writing letters at night or receiving occasional visits from friends and family. No one moves away or goes to concerts. The problem of burnout exists for prisoners, but there is sometimes a stronger peer group, and this helps to support and reinforce the values of the group. The motivation for being involved might be any number of things, but the prevalent one among the population is usually the basic living conditions and general treatment of prisoners at the hands of the guards. So there was a captive audience, so to speak, in the penitentiary. The people being organized were always available, morning, noon, and night, and the motivation for involvement was continuously reinforced by the prison administration itself. It seemed like the ideal situation for an organizer. But I had to wonder why my hair was turning gray. This being my first experience with imprisonment, I was somewhat naive. I would soon find out that the potential for conflict was a constant and ever-present danger, one that was encouraged by various elements within the guard force.
You've been listening to Radio KWTF, the program Voices from Behind the Walls, and readings from Marshall Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther by Marshall Eddie Conway and Dominic Stevens. Today's reading was done by Marty McReynolds and David Angle. We invite you to join us next time for further readings from this book written by Marshall Eddie Conway and Dominic Stevens. This is Albert Big Man Howard once again thanking you for joining KWTF Community Radio, Sonoma County and the world. We'll be right back.
This has been another presentation of Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard. For more information on how to volunteer or to donate to KWTF, go to our website, kwtf.net. Next week, more Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard.